back down and shut your trap. It's time for
Keeping it sports with them three.
Are you ready?
Are you ready?
Well, I'll need some beer.
Are you ready?
You have to ask me nicely.
Come on now, don't be bashful.
Are you ready,
Place for the best sports talk and news surrounding each league.
I can prove it with my usual flawless logic.
Hey man, this time I'll do it my way.
What's your name again?
And now, here's your host, M3, Mike Rosansky. Coming to you from Freehold, New Jersey, it's time for Keeping It Sports with M3, powered by normally the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, but I guess only this week by Facebook and wherever else you listen to a podcast. Good afternoon, everyone. Hope everything's going well for you here on this Tuesday, the second day of April. I am, of course, Mike M3 Rosansky. Hope you're, if you're dealing with this bad weather day we got going on here in New Jersey, I hope you're doing it safely and getting through your Tuesday, you know, relatively uneventful after what was a very exciting month of March. Now heading into the month of April, a lot to talk about this week. Give you some early thoughts on both the Mets and Yankees. Try not to overreact to anything as they've both only played about four or five games up until this point. Mix in a lot of football, as well as a piece of news that came out last week that I don't think anyone should really be surprised about. Something that I thought, if you've paid attention to the sports world, it was only a matter of time with the direction that some of these sports leagues and conferences and ownerships are going in recent years, that we would see a story like this. But we're going to start off today with the end of March Madness, which is now bleeding into April with the NCAA tournaments. And I said that plurally because the women's tournament deserves as much attention, respect, recognition as the men's tournament. Hell, maybe you could even argue more so than the men's tournament. Because when I look at both of these tournaments, when I look at the men's bracket and the women's bracket, now we're down to the final four in both of them. The men's bracket is more about storylines. The men's bracket, you have your teams, at least a couple of them, that you expected to be here. And then you have two surprises, two teams that at the beginning of this tournament that I'm not sure exactly how many thought were going to make it to the Final Four, especially in the case of a team like NC State. Whereas on the women's side of things, more of the attention is less on the overall teams, but more so on the individual star power, the individual that are capturing our attention, that are showing that the women's game is as exciting, hell, maybe even more so than the men's game. Because when it comes to the men's game, you have teams there, but these teams, the big time programs, tend not to stick together for a very long time, tend not to have these guys build camaraderie, build a cohesiveness over a couple of years, because the money is so good in the NBA that after a year or two, hell, maybe even after, say, just two semesters, these guys are getting up on out of there and heading to the NBA. Whereas in the women's game, because you don't make that kind of financial impact
in the WNBA, unfortunately. And a lot of your playing career is based internationally. The women tend to stay in school a lot longer. You see them. You see them play longer. You see these teams, these groups of women stick together a lot longer than you see with the men. And you get to know them. You get to know them and learn their story. Where sometimes with some of these men's players, yeah, they were a hot shot for a year or so in college, but they go into the shark-infested waters that are the NBA. And sometimes we never hear from them again. Sometimes they're complete afterthoughts when they get to the NBA. So that you have a differing of stories here, but it doesn't take away from the excitement. It just adds something different to both sides and allows for each side to have their own differing entertainment purposes. You look at the men's side in our Final Four there. It's Purdue versus NC State. You have redemption going up against a historic run because Purdue is coming off of what was one of the most embarrassing losses in college basketball history just last year, becoming that second team to lose to a 16 seed in the first round of the tournament. And as we all know, the last time this happened, Virginia in 2018 would lose to a 16 seed, would go on and win the championship the following year. And that's what Purdue is trying to do here. And, you know, you can look at it, it's them against time when you consider this is the last year of Zach Edey. I know it seemed like he's been in college forever, but it's their last year with their star player, a guy who's put up record numbers, record performances there, a guy who in all likelihood someday is going to have his numbers up in the Raptors. And they'd like to cement that legacy with the championship. But you're going up against the darling of this tournament. The team that, if you didn't have a team going into this, or if your bracket has been completely destroyed at this point, you're now rooting for them. You're now saying, hey, I can get behind that. I can support that. I can believe in that. In NC State, who, you look at them, a 9-game winning streak. This is a team that had to win their conference tournament just to get in. They, remember, they won 5 games in 5 days. They had a losing record in conference. I think they were, 9-11, 9-12, something along those lines. There was a lot of talk that Kevin Keats was going to get fired by NC State. And here they are 3 weeks later in the Final Four of the NCAA tournament. Their first appearance in the Final Four since Jimmy V's famous team from 1983 making that historic run en route to winning a championship. And they've taken down some of the top dogs along the way. They eliminated the number 2 seed in their part of the bracket in Marquette last week. Then over the weekend, took care of business against Duke and have just left these teams flustered, saying, wait a minute, this team was average, mediocre all year long, and now they've suddenly come alive in the tournament. Well, you're seeing this kid, DJ Burns, he's made a name for himself. So much so that even NFL teams are saying to themselves, hey, maybe we should reach out to him, see if he wants to switch from basketball to football and play either offensive or a defensive line, because he's been throwing people around in the paint throughout this tournament. You're getting solid performances from the likes of DJ Horn and Muhammad Daria, and, you know, catching a slight bit of luck along the way, whether it be a bad shooting night from Duke's big star Kyle Filipowski, or on the Sweet 16, Marquette shooting just 4 for 31 from 3, being what I would refer to as drunk from behind the three-point arc, and pretty much killing their chances of trying to come back against this darling of a team. On the other side of things, you've got the chance of history going up against the forgotten team. And of course, that forgotten team is Alabama. Because we think about Alabama as a football school. We don't think about them as a basketball program. But they took down half of the remaining teams in the ACC over the weekend, including shocking North Carolina, coming back from trailing at halftime. RJ Davis had a rare off night for him. Grant Nelson turned out to be the star, including with the go-ahead three with about 30 seconds to go in this game. And Alabama just left North Carolina shocked last Thursday night. And on top of that, they followed up by beating up Clemson with a just dominant performance behind the three-point arc. And it's crazy to think about. They missed 12 of their first 13 shots from behind the three-point arc, and then would go on to make 15 of their next 25 attempts. Clemson was a team that had only allowed 14 three-pointers through the first three games of this tournament. And here is Alabama shooting lights out against them. And they're going to need more of that if they have any hope, any chance of pulling off what would be, in my mind, a miraculous upset. And I know you can never say never in sports, but UConn just seems like men on a mission. They are not just beating teams. They are destroying teams. They are obliterating the competition. They have won every game in this tournament by an average of 27 points. The closest game they played was in the second round against Northwestern. That was a 17-point game, but after the first couple of minutes, didn't even seem like a competitive matchup. They run through San Diego State. They had that crazy 30-0 run against Illinois. And they're doing it a different way each night. One night, it's their guards dominating. And they've got three big guards on that team that are all probably going to play in the league. Then against Illinois, it's Donovan Clingan destroying them inside. He's had a great tournament so far. You'd like to see how they handle some kind of adversity, considering no one's been close to being competitive to them in about a month now. But can any of these teams bring that? Can any of these remaining three teams be someone that stops them, that shocks them, and provides some kind of resistance to the dominance UConn is having? But we could be heading toward a UConn-dominated April here, because think about it. 20 years ago, UConn became the first school to win the men's and women's national championships in the same season. Remember, the Diana Taurasi team, and then a largely forgotten UConn men's team. Some of those guys made it to the league, but for the most part, they didn't have any real quote-unquote stars on it. 10 years later, Kevin Ollie and still Gino Auriemma were leading teams back to that spot, winning championships again. And now we head to 2024, and what do you know? They're in position to do it again, be the only school to not just do this multiple times, but do this in general. But there's a lot going up against UConn here on the women's side. Remember, I said it's been very star-centric on that side of things. And last night, if you're one of the pioneers of women's college basketball, that had to be a night where you looked at it, you smiled, you maybe had a tear in your eye. If you're, you know, the Sarah Millers of the world, Lisa Leslie's, Diana Taurasi, Brittany Griner, Maya Moore, any of those pioneers that built the way to this moment, where you probably had the most captivating night of women's college basketball in history. All of the attention of the sports world seemed focused on these women and what they were bringing to the table. You get a rematch of the national championship between Caitlin Clark's Iowa team and Angel Reese's LSU team. Then you get UConn with Paige Becker going up against Juju Watkins and USC. It was must-see television. It was exciting television. And Caitlin Clark was able to light up LSU once again. See, here's the thing. When it comes to Caitlin Clark, you're not going to stop her. Even Kim Mulkey said it after the game. You're not going to stop her. You just got to hope that no one else does anything. That's how LSU beat Iowa last year. They couldn't stop Caitlin Clark. It's just they were able to contain everyone else. The problem for LSU became last night. First off, it looked like Iowa was going to blow them out of the gym in the first quarter with how they were raining down on threes. But then Angel Reese really started to get going. Looked like it was going to be a back and forth show between her and Caitlin Clark once again. But I don't think Angel Reese was ever the same after that injury when she came up limping early there in the second quarter, because she was cooking in that first quarter. First quarter, she had 10 points, had 5 rebounds, 3 assists, stole the ball a couple times, but then she injures her ankle, had to leave the game for a couple minutes. It looked at the time a lot worse than it really was. And in the end, she got into foul trouble, and with her off the court, LSU was not able to match Iowa bucket for bucket and came up short in their hopes of repeating. You follow that up with UConn versus USC with Paige Becker and Juju Watkins. And listen, we'd be talking about Paige Becker putting up the same kind of numbers, putting up the same kind of historic performances as we see from Caitlin Clark, if not for all of the injuries she's had these last couple of years. She, while she does play for UConn and at times playing for Gino Auriemma team, players can get, should we say, lost in the sauce there, because you have so many stars that have come and gone through that program over the years. When you have one of these lightning bolt of a stars, just because it's a program that has been always dominant doesn't mean they shouldn't get their individual shine, their individual attention. And she was able to outshine Juju Watkins last night. And listen, Juju Watkins, the loss, it does not take away from what was a phenomenal freshman year for her. We'll see if it continues, if she decides to come back for another year. As I said, it's a difficult decision for the women, more so than the men, because you're not making the same kind of money going pro in the women's game. Hell, you probably make more money staying in college when it comes to the women's game than you do going pro with your initial rookie contract. But it was, no matter the outcomes of these games, it was an amazing night for women's college basketball. Something that you like to see if you're a fan of the sport. Hell, even if you're just a casual basketball fan, casual college basketball fan like I am. I don't pay attention to college basketball throughout the regular season on the night in, night out basis. I kind of hover over it and see what's going on. But last night was a very successful night. Last night was a very fun night. And last night continued to show why we love sports. And why, as I said earlier, it may be two different dynamics in the men's and women's game. Stories versus star power. But it hasn't taken away from what has been a very exciting March Madness season. Very exciting NCAA tournaments for both the men and the women. All right, got to take my first break of the podcast, but got a lot I want to talk about today. Mixing some early thoughts on both the Mets and Yankees coming up. A crazy story coming out of the NBA that we really should not be shocked about. Of course, mixing some football as well along the way. So, a lot to get to over the next about 45 minutes or so here. Glad you could be joining me this week, whether you're watching live on Facebook or listening to the podcast version later on in the day. And as I say, each and every single week at this time, please sit back, relax, help, put your feet up and relax, and continue keeping it sports with M3.
I'll be back.
We're only a couple of days into the Major League Baseball season, so it's way too early to have a reaction to anything going on. I think in life, we're too quick to make judgments. We're too quick to react to things. We don't let things play out very often and just want to have some kind of immediacy to things. Just want to have some kind of quick, rampant reaction to the first thing we see rather than just let things play out. Because right now, doesn't matter where you turn in this area, it seems to have one constant theme. The Yankees are amazing and the Mets just look like absolute hot garbage. Because the Yankees are off to a 5-0 start. Meanwhile, the New York Mets are 0-4 and seemingly can't get out of their own way. And I came into the season with this mindset when it came to both teams. The Yankees, there were clear things I was concerned about. You know, not having Gerrit Cole, Judge's toe, and how much it was going to be impacted with him playing center field, and then the rotation without Gerrit Cole, with Rodon coming off of what was a injury-plagued and awful season, and at times he seemed like the most hated Yankee on the roster, not named Josh Donaldson. You had an injury-plagued season for Nestor Cortez. And then you're relying on Marcus Stroman and a couple of kids at the back end of the rotation. Well, we were quick to judge. We were quick to react. I know I was on Thursday in their first game when Nestor Cortez got beat around a little bit in the first inning. I started thinking, uh-oh, is Nestor just a one-year wonder? Was that kind of a flukish thing in 2022, and he's more of a jack-of-all-trades long reliever? I was asking friends, what is the leash on Nestor Cortez for this season, even with Gerrit Cole likely out until June? But I give him a lot of credit. I give him credit for the resiliency he showed after that first inning, the bounce back, the fact that he didn't just let the game completely get away from him. And you got to give this Yankee team a lot of credit because, let's face it, Houston has been a house of horrors for the Yankees over the years. Not just with the recent incarnation of the Houston Astros, the Altuves, the Bregmans, the Yordan Alvarez team, Justin Verlander, all the pitchers they've had over the years. It seems like since that place was built, hell, you go back to when the Astros were still in the National League Central, it feels like that was a place that the Yankees and Yankee fans did not like seeing their team go to. And we know the history with these two franchises, where the Houston Astros have knocked the Yankees out of the postseason four times in the last 8 years. And while this series over the weekend does not decide anything in the long term, does not guarantee that the Yankees would have home field advantage over the Houston Astros in a postseason series if both teams were to get that far, because hey, Houston could turn around and win 97 games. The Yankees win only 95. And then they play in the postseason. Houston would have home field for either the division series or the ALCS. But it is a good early salvo. It is a good early potential message being sent. And it's a good early vibe that you get from this Yankee team. Because the first three games of this series, they trailed in each one of them. Not as big as they did on Thursday, trailing 4-0 after the first two innings. But you saw a lot of fight. You saw a lot of grit from these Yankees over these last couple days. Especially when, let's face it, Aaron Judge did nothing. Outside of one big home run, Giancarlo Stanton was relatively quiet. It was a lot of the other guys, the lesser known players, the young guys in the bottom of the order that were getting the job done. Like Anthony Volpe looks like a completely different player this year. He seemed to have evened out his swing. He's taken more pitches. He's not so concentrated on hitting the ball upward and getting power, has more of a level approach to him. And Oswaldo Cabrera was red hot in this series. And I love the fact that Boone actually managed here, because it seemed like Oswaldo Cabrera was only playing on Thursday because John Birdie, who they got in a trade about 24 hours before that game, only arrived in Houston at 2 a.m. So they start Cabrera. He had a big home run to help lead the comeback. And you figure, all right, he played well, but Boone will probably go to Birdie. No, stuck with Cabrera each game of that series. He stuck with the hot hand. And that's something the Yankees have not necessarily always believed in. They've never been one of these teams that believes in hot or believes in riding the hot hand. Remember, they give unnecessary days off at times. But between what you saw from these two kids as well as you saw for the first time over this weekend what all the hype is about. What all of the, we understand why he's so great when it comes to Juan Soto. Because we've seen Soto over the years. We've seen glimpses of him. But when you see him on a day in, day out basis, that's when you really realize how great this kid is. And he's only 25 years old. He's barely scratching the surface of his prime. And he's already put up historic numbers. He's already put up numbers that put him on pace to be one of the greatest players we've ever seen in this sport. Some of the at-bats that he takes, the pitches that he takes in these at-bats, especially on Sunday in the at-bat against Josh Hader, where he's taking pitches on the inside corner that he wasn't even contemplating, wasn't even thinking for 1 second about chasing or swinging at. And then to turn that 97, 98 mile an hour fastball on the outside corner and lace it into left field for the go-ahead hit on Sunday afternoon was just a brilliant at-bat by him. Most other guys we've seen with the Yankees would have tried to hit a bomb, would have tried to blast one out of the ballpark. But this guy just takes what's given to him, makes the hard seem easy and the easy seem extremely simple, and is going to be an amazing show to watch this year. The overreaction you're seeing from Yankee fans is, oh, just give him a blank check. Give him whatever he wants. Calm down. It's five games. Yes, it's been awesome what we've got him from Soto so far. But let's let the entire season play out. Let's not just rush to giving him what is a record-breaking contract. Because you're saying give him whatever he wants. He could ask for $100 million a year. You're giving him that. Calm down, people. And all of this great effort you've seen these five games been backed by amazing work out of the Yankee bullpen. Now, listen, I don't want to see four-plus innings out of the bullpen every single night. And I got to be honest with you, outside of Clay Holmes, Jonathan Loaisiga, and Ian Hamilton, I wasn't really sure who any of these guys were coming into this season. I think Luke Weaver pitched a couple of games late in September last year, but Nick Birdie, Victor Gonzalez, Cal Ferguson, guys that you really have never heard of before in your life, coming in and getting the job done and being a big part of why this team is off to a 5-0 start and laid the groundwork for a good cushion. Now, listen, doesn't guarantee anything. Hell, they could lose these next two games to Arizona and go back to New York 5-2. But you've seen differences. You've seen changes so far in this team that you didn't see last year. Last year, you get down big early, they weren't coming back. This year, there's a grittiness. There's toughness to this team. There's a moxie to this team that you haven't seen from many Yankee teams in recent history. There's a battle, a will to them. How last year, you would have seen Cortez and Rodon get destroyed and out of the game by the third inning. But they battled early struggles, kept the team in the game, and allowed the Yankees to wear down the middle relief of the Houston Astros bullpen. And that's something that used to be a calling card for the Yankees that up until these first five games of the season, we hadn't seen much in the last couple of years. And while you don't want to overreact to things too much, it feels like same old when it comes to the Mets. And I don't want to completely just flip out. I don't want to completely just destroy them by the 0-4 start. It doesn't help that you're going up against a Brewers team that lost several members of the rotation this offseason, including trading their ace, Corbin Burns, and lost their manager in Craig Counsell. But then to lose to the Tigers last night in 10 innings, not score a run, and you're seeing the same problems with this Mets team that you've seen in recent memory, in recent history, where they're so far on the season, 3-for-20 with runners in scoring position, getting shut out by no-name pitchers. Hell, opening day, Marte gets a home run early, and then they can do nothing against Freddy Peralta. Now, he's a representable name. He's a good pitcher. But you're getting just shut out, getting no hit at points in games by guys that you have to go through the team catalog to see who the hell is this guy? Who is this that's on the mound? And on top of that, the embarrassment. The fact that the Mets have no guts. The Mets have no toughness to them when it comes to that Rhys Hoskins situation. And we've known this since Rhys Hoskins' days with the Philadelphia Phillies. He's one of those guys that you love him if he's on your team, and you hate his guts if he's playing for the opponent. While I look at that slide on McNeil late in the game on Friday, I didn't think it was dirty, but I also thought it was kind of late and unnecessary. But there must be some kind of mindset here with the New York Mets. And I came across this going through some of the film that John Boy Media provides on social media every day. They did a pretty good breakdown on this, and it was something that hadn't even crossed my mind. But if you watch the Mets in recent years, when it comes to any of their guys with any form of speed, Nimmo, Lindor, McNeil, anybody that has some kind of speed that could potentially break up a double play. You watch any Mets game and you see the potential for a breakup in a double play. You see McNeil stop in between first and second with a give-up slide that isn't even within 10 feet of either the second baseman or shortstop. Lindor and Nimmo just pretty much run out to center field, don't even head towards second base, give up on the play altogether. There must be something in the Mets' mindset that you are not allowed to break up a double play attempt. And then Rhys Hoskins, who I'll admit it, is kind of an annoying guy, he's rubbing his eyes as if to call McNeil a crybaby, albeit he's doing it while standing behind other people. McNeil is cursing him out, was cursing him out, looking at the ground, yelling at him at the beginning of the play. Show a set and knock the living crap out of the guy. The Mets do a lot of talking, do a lot of woe is me, claiming they're the victim, but never stand up for themselves, never defend themselves. They've been hit probably more than any team in baseball in recent years, and their pitchers never retaliate. Or if they do retaliate, they retaliate at the wrong times. Take, for example, Saturday afternoon would have been a perfect tone setter moment for Luis Severino. He's on a new team. He's trying to build up camaraderie with his new teammates, create a new vibe moving from the Yankees to the Mets after what was a really disappointing season for him last year. And he goes out there, rather than, you know, take care of business, throw one at the hip or the shins of Hoskins early on. I'm not saying at the shoulder or neck or head area. Just throw one low inside, send a message. And instead, Hoskins is treating him like batting practice. Then the Mets, I don't know to this moment whether it was retaliatory. It was probably just Ramirez can't control the baseball. He throws one behind Hoskins in the seventh inning. Ramirez gets thrown out of the game. And it just was a bad look, a bad representation on a moment to retaliate. You had your chance in the second inning on his first at bat, and you didn't take it then. You didn't take the opportunity when it was presented to you. And you look like a bunch of clowns. You look like a bunch of small little crybabies starting what could be another miserable year for you, because you have no offense through these first four games, and then you embarrass yourself with the lack of retaliation against a guy that has pretty much owned you over the course of his career.
I'll be back.
There is very much hypocrisy going on in the professional sports world these days. Because while we the fans want everything to seem real, we want full transparency, we don't want the sports world to seem scripted, we don't want it to feel like it's the WWE or a drama that is just played out in an athletic endeavor. We want the results to feel real. We know all of these sports leagues and all of these channels, whether it be ESPN, Fox, CBS, you name them, they're all in bed with the gambling sites. Hell, there's not a replay that goes on in a sporting event these days that doesn't have some kind of endorsement, some kind of sponsorship from a gambling site. So it shouldn't be a surprise when we've seen in the last couple of years NFL players, lower level players mostly, that have tried to get away with either gambling on the game or gambling on other sports while on the practice facility, or what we're seeing go on with the Shohei Ohtani situation. Now we've got one going on in the NBA as Raptors forward Jontay Porter is under investigation following multiple instances of betting irregularities over the last several months. And if you haven't paid attention to this story very much, what has gone on here is in sports, you have what is called prop bets, where, there's over-unders on players scoring for that night, or over-unders on their rebounds, steals, assists along that. You have it in every sport. You have an over-under on how many hits a player will get in that given night. Hell, you can even gamble in the NFL quarter-to-quarter. You can gamble in Major League Baseball at bat-to-at-bat based on the spread. Pretty much anything you can think of, you can gamble on in the sports world these days. Well, in two games over the last couple of months, there were instances where Jontay Porter had increased betting interest for the unders on his prop bets that night, whether it be January 26th against the Clippers. His props were set at 5.5 points, 4.5 rebounds, and 1.5 assists. There was also an over-under for made threes that night at 0.5. Well, he left the game with just 4 minutes of playing time that night. And in that game, the unders of all of those were bet heavily, especially that under 0.5 point of threes made in that game. And normally in prop betting, you're allowed a certain limit. You're typically only allowed a limit of like 1 to 2,000. Well, you had these large bets coming in of anywhere between $10,000 and $20,000 across multiple sports gambling sites on the unders. It happened again on March 20th when Porter played just 3 minutes before exiting due to what the Raptors were calling an illness. The sportsbooks had his over-unders that night set at 7.5 points and at 5.5 rebounds. And he played only 3 minutes. The next day, DraftKings Sportsbook reported in a media release that the prop bets for Jontae Porter's bets were number one amongst moneymakers from that night in the NBA. And listen, it remains to be seen whether Jontae Porter was part of this, if he has any real involvement in this at all. But it's not a good look for the league if you have a guy potentially doing this and it goes uninvestigated. That's why you do like that the gambling sites will report it to the league, because hey, they're losing money if they see a player trying to, you know, corrupt the system, if they see a player trying to fix things. But at the same time, when it's a guy like this, a guy that's on a two-way contract, that's making only $415,000 over the course of this season, can you really blame him? Can you really hold it against that guy for wanting to skate the system here? Once again, I don't know. We don't know. No one knows if he has any part of this or if this is friends of his letting know. And we see this from players all the time. They're saying that, oh, we hear from fans during the course of the game, hey, I've got your under on the points tonight. But this is the first time this has popped up in the NBA. And quite frankly, I'm surprised this hasn't happened already, with how easy it is to gamble on anything these days and how you could potentially go under a fake name. I'm surprised that more players in the position of Jontae Porter haven't tried this. And the NBA, NFL, Major League Baseball, all these sports leagues, they got no one to blame for this but themselves, because they get into bed with these gambling sites. They make money head and foot off each other. So they shouldn't be surprised when this is popping up. Now, the NFL made some news this past week, and they tried to cover up the real headline here. They put out all these rule changes for this coming season, whether it be the banning of the hip drop tackles, new rules for kickoffs and onside kicks. And there was a lot of reaction from people saying, oh, I like somewhat of a change in the kickoffs, penalize teams more for a possible touchback. Fans were more so reticent about the fact that there can't be surprise onside kicks. But let's face it, those have been once in a blue moon kind of situations. People act like the Sean Payton New Orleans Saints halftime surprise by the Saints is a regular thing. No, it's not. That was a once in a lifetime thing. That was really a spur of the moment kind of situation where they were trying to change the momentum of the Super Bowl to start the second half. We don't see that many surprise onside kicks in the NFL to warrant it having such outrage about that getting banned, that getting prohibited. I do like that the NFL is making some kind of change, an interesting change here to the kickoffs, and going with more of the model that has been done in recent years by the XFL, where the kickers will continue to kick from the 35-yard line. But the other 10 players on the field with them from the kickoff team will line up at the receiving team's 40-yard line. Then there will be a setup zone between the 35 and 30-yard line of the return team with at least 9 players on their team. And you can have up to 2 players in what they're calling the landing zone between the 20-yard line and the goal line. And no one other than the kicker and the returner can move until the ball hits the ground or hits a player inside the landing zone. So there's not going to be the ability to rush down there and potentially get a muffed kick on a kickoff, even though we don't see that very often anyway. But we've seen in recent years the kickoff has become kind of a non-factor. It's been kind of the bathroom break spot for fans. Now it's something that you may have to pay attention to. But all of these rules cover up what was the big story for the NFL last week. And that's their continued greed. That's their continued being money hogs. That's their continued realizing that they've got us bent over and can really do anything to us that they want. When they announced that the NFL will play 2 games on Christmas Day this coming season. And for anyone out there listening or watching, you know what day Christmas falls on this year? It's not one of your typical football days. I'll give you a clue. It's not Thursday, not Sunday, not Monday. Hell, it's not even Saturday. Christmas this year is going to fall, wait for it, on a Wednesday. What a bunch of hypocritical frauds they are. Because this is the same league that came out last year and said after Christmas Day, we will not play games on Tuesday or Wednesday. But then what happened? They saw the ratings from Christmas Day. Remember that triple header that they held? Especially the ratings for the Christmas night game between the Ravens and the 49ers that had more than 27 million viewers, making it the second most watched Monday Night Football game in 28 years. You know, the last time they played a game on a Wednesday was back in 2021 when there was an outbreak of COVID that forced the Ravens Steelers to move their game from Thanksgiving to the following Wednesday. But at least they had a reason then. This is just the NFL saying, screw you to the NBA. You're no longer owning Christmas Day. We've got the fans bent over. We can do whatever we want to them. They continue to buy Peacock and view when we annoyingly stream a playoff game on there, get Amazon Prime, and watch the crappy product that is Thursday Night Football. Hell, they're even going to have a game from Sao Paulo, Brazil, this coming year in week 1, when the Eagles will play a home game on a Friday afternoon on Peacock. It's unbelievable. And the NFL continues to set new lows for themselves, but they're winning the battle against us, folks, unfortunately. Every time we think they can't get any lower, they do. But they keep pulling a new one over on us, and it's not going to change anytime soon. Unfortunately, I think we could be heading for a dark day where maybe even eventually the Super Bowl is on one of these ridiculous streaming services. And would that really surprise you? If they're willing to play games on Christmas Day, a Wednesday, would anything that they do going forward surprise you? And hell, Major League Baseball plays games in Seoul, South Korea at 3 a.m. West Coast time. Would it surprise you if at some point the NFL doesn't try to do the same?
I'll be back.
I want to get back to women's college basketball for a second here, because while I had no rooting interest last night in either one of the games, I was just looking forward to the star power that you had on display here, the fact that we were getting a rematch of last year's finals between LSU and Iowa before the Final Four, something that I wasn't much of a fan of, something I know a lot of people heading into this tournament weren't much of a fan of. We would have preferred if that meeting at the very earliest was in the Final Four. I will admit, I've never been a big fan of LSU's head coach, Kim Mulkey. She comes across as a little bit whiny, a little bit annoying. Some of her antics on the bench at times can wear on opposing fans, can wear probably on referees, and just, you want to scream at the TV, be like, come on, shut up. Just coach your team and stop trying to make the show about you. But where I do have to give her credit and where I do have to defend her is I feel that in the last year since LSU won the national championship, the coverage on this team, not just Angel Reese, but this entire team has been outright ridiculous, outright disrespectful, and outright just wrong. You go back to when they won the national championship against Iowa. People were criticizing Angel Reese because she was doing the John Cena, you can't see me taunt at Caitlin Clark late in that game when LSU had all but locked up the game. But as I continue to bring up, Caitlin Clark was doing that earlier in the tournament and no one else had a problem. You're going to have a problem with Angel Reese doing it back to her. Then you had people critical throughout this year of this team, whether it be when Kim Mulkey wasn't giving anyone any answers as to why Angel Reese was pulled from a game in January at halftime and then didn't see the court for another four games. Listen, sometimes things are none of our damn business. We need to mind our own damn business. And if there was something personal going on, if there was some kind of disciplinary reason for it, that's Kim Mulkey, Angel Reese, and LSU's business. And that's not for us to decide when answers are given to that or to judge them on any decisions being made there. I'm just glad that when she came back, it turned out she was okay. That was my concern there. It wasn't that, oh, was she being disciplined or anything like that? I just want to know, is she okay? Is she physically fine? There's nothing, you know, medically wrong with her. If she's dealing with some kind of personal issue at the time, that's her business and her business alone. But as long as she's alive and well, that's my only concern as a sports fan and a far away viewer. But then the coverage, as we've gotten closer to this tournament, and in this tournament, has just been outright disrespectful. It's bad enough that there's a Washington Post article out there that some may view as a slam piece toward Kim Mulkey. Others may view as a revealing article that Kim Mulkey may not have wanted out there as far as treatment toward past players, whether it be African-American players or players that were gay or transgender. But what came out over the weekend by a columnist named Ben Bulch from the Los Angeles Times was outright ridiculous. He wrote a piece talking about the LSU-UCLA matchup in the previous round of the NCAA tournament and betrayed the matchup between the two teams as a reckoning between good versus evil. Even in a column on Friday, it described LSU as a team of dirty debutants and UCLA as milk and cookies. Are you freaking kidding me? Ladies and gentlemen, if you don't know what a debutant is, I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Actually, quite frankly, I don't care if I'm pronouncing that right. It's an outright disgusting word. And if you don't know what it is, don't know what it means, go on Google right now and type in the term debutants. And you'll see what I'm talking about as far as what an embarrassment that is to describe anyone, especially a woman, in that term. And calling this team dirty debutants, a team that's largely made up of young female African Americans, is quite frankly racist to me. The article where he calls it good versus evil is, just as Kim Mulkey said, wrong. It reminds me of back in the 90s. Remember in college football when Notre Dame and the University of Miami would play, and there was someone out there that referred to that matchup as the meeting of Catholics versus convicts? This is what this is once again. It's entirely racist. It's entirely disrespectful. And while I normally don't like to be someone that calls for someone's job, and hey, what power does my voice really have in all this? The LA Times really needs to think about pulling this writer, suspending him at the very least, hell, possibly even firing him over this. Describing someone as a debutant, that to me borderlines on as bad as what Don Imus once said about the Rutgers female basketball team. Just disgusting, embarrassing, and something that the LA Times should be ashamed of themselves that they let a writer, A, send that article in, and B, that it was ever put in their paper or posted it on their online newspaper. Just embarrassing and disrespectful toward Mulkey and her team. I guess I'll finish up talking about my Jets, who, kind of a mixed bag week. I started off the week kind of annoyed with them when Woody Johnson put out what felt like a very tone-deaf statement talking about Zach Wilson, saying that the Jets will not cut Zach Wilson if they are unable to trade him. And what I don't get here is the Jets have, from all reports, trade offers on the table. And there's nothing that suffice their interest. Guys, if you can get anything, even a case of Gatorade for Zach Wilson, you do the trade at this point and get this kid the hell out of here. Because while not all of what's gone on here in his failures has been his fault, there's just a negative aura, a negative vibe that hangs over this franchise by having Zach Wilson still here. And you've got a clean slate with this. You've got to move on. It was a bust of a second overall draft pick. But clearly, Woody Johnson still has some kind of attachment to this kid. And his comments come across as tone deaf when he's saying, quote, he's been in the fire from day one. And I think what he needs to be in a place where he can observe for a while. He's got the skills. He can do everything. There's a reason he was drafted 2 overall. And I have confidence that he'll get there at some point. I'll tell you this much, Woody. It damn sure ain't happening here. You watch the kid play. He's been a big part of a lot of the losing that the Jets have had in recent years. Now, the Jets have had some awful offensive lines, but he's had awful decision-making. And while you could say, yeah, this was supposed to be a redshirt year, not many people have a redshirt year in their third year in the NFL. So enough with the nonsense. If you can get a 7th-round draft pick for him, you do it. Even if it's a 7th-round pick in this year's draft, where you, in all likelihood, are drafting someone that you're going to cut on the third day of training camp, do it. Get this kid the hell up out of here. He has no value at this point, and it just creates a negative aura over this organization if he's still here. Because, you know, with the Jets' luck, watch. If he's still here at the start of this season, Aaron Rodgers will get injured again. Tyrod Taylor will then get injured. And what do you know? You're right back to Zach Wilson. Enough with the crap. Move on. But I will give the Jets credit in that they've had a solid offseason. They've made some very wise decisions, whether it be trading for Morgan Moses, the signing of Tyrone Smith, signing of Mike Williams, guys that are older players on essentially one-year deals that are still useful players, but in some cases have had some injury concerns. It's very much a go-for-it type of year with these moves. These are not thinking about the long-term impact of this franchise kind of moves. And they added to that last week with adding Hassan Reddick in a trade from the Eagles. Hassan Reddick, who had won in a new deal from the Eagles. He's got 1 year left on his contract. Wanted a new deal, but the Eagles weren't willing to give him that. I think that's part of the reason why they were willing to shell over so much money for Bryce Huff on the first day of free agency. And the Jets have been looking to add a replacement for Bryce Huff. And you get one of the best options that there was out there. A guy who's had 15.5 sacks over the past 4 seasons. Has had 10 sacks in each of the 2 seasons with Philadelphia. He's a guy that is durable, is on the field a lot. He's even better when it comes to stopping the run than is Bryce Huff. There's a lot of fans out there that would say, oh, why didn't you re-sign Bryce Huff? Because if you prorate Huff's numbers out to the amount of time that Reddick is on the field, they're essentially the same player. But the Jets just did not want to shell out that kind of guarantee to Huff. But the problem is, what you're running into here with Reddick, he's on the final year of his deal. And the Jets could possibly re-sign him after next year. But after next year, you got to start looking into the future with a lot of your upcoming guys that need to get paid. The likes of Jermaine Johnson, the likes of Sauce Gardner, or Garrett Wilson. So I like the move on paper. It's definitely an upgrade on this team. It provides more time for Will McDonald, who you don't have to just completely throw him into the fire and say, oh, you're immediately the starter. Provides him some competition. And, you know, competition can bring out the best out of people. I think that's what has brought out the best in the second year of Jermaine Johnson. You hope that does the same for Will McDonald this year. So I do definitely like this move on paper. I like what the Jets have done this offseason. But now you look ahead to the draft, and the Jets have put themselves in an interesting spot. They've put themselves in a spot where they can be very mature in the first round of the draft. You're already seeing reports over the weekend that they would like to trade back from the number 10 overall pick to a team that could possibly be looking to draft a quarterback. And the Jets, it would be a prudent move for them to do, because while there's a lot of fans out there that say, oh, just go for Brock Bowers at 10, or take the best overall tackle at 10. The Jets could use a lot more good young talent on this team. And if you could say, trade back, there's still a good offensive lineman at the spot you move back to, and recoup a second round draft pick in that, I'm all for it. I'm all for trading back there. And there's teams within reason of trading back that you could get a pretty nice return package from. I don't think the Vikings traded into the first round for a second time to trade up one spot with the Jets, so I think that's out of the question. But you got teams like Denver at 12, the Raiders at 13, even the Seahawks at 16, because I don't think they're completely locked in on Geno Smith being their long-term guy, who could be looking up to trade for a quarterback if, say, oh, I don't know, Michael Penix. If Michael Penix is available at 10, like most people expect him to be, that could be the guy that you see the Raiders, the Broncos, and the Seahawks potentially trying to trade up and grab. So the Jets have put themselves in a solid spot going into this draft. But let's see if they're going to be mature about it, if they're going to make the right decision here, or if it's going to be an Aaron Rodgers decision. I personally, if they could trade back, get more picks, and go offensive line with that first pick, considering Moses and Tyrone Smith are on the last years of their deal, that is what I would do. But as we've known in the past, the Jets have not always been that team to make the smart decisions. And now, my friends, let's keep it in sports with M3 for Tuesday, April 2nd, 2024. Everyone, please have a great night. Have a fun, safe, happy, healthy week. Hell, yep, one life, people. You might as well live it up. And I'll talk to you guys again at some point next week. Until then, peace.
We have to go. Good night, everybody.
I have had enough of you.
Thank you for all the fun. Thank you. Hey, shut up, will ya?
I don't want to see you. I don't want to hear you. I don't want to smell you. Now leave.
I'll be back.